Hello, listeners, and welcome to CMI's Peace Talks. I'm your host, Antti Ämmälä, CMI's Communications Manager. In this show, we look at the world through the lenses of peacemaking. We have conversations with both our own and other top experts on what it takes to build lasting peace in this unstable world situation. In the wise words of our founder, Nobel Peace Laureate Martti Ahtisaari, we believe that all conflicts can be resolved. This podcast is about how to do it. By 2050, extreme heat can make parts of the Middle East impossible to live in. Millions of people would have to find themselves a new home. In Western Africa, it's said that the drying of Lake Chad is driving recruitment for terrorist group Boko Haram. And in Asia, the control of river water could become an extra source of conflict between India and Pakistan. These are just a few examples of how climate change can add to instability in the world. Today, we take a good look at the links between climate change and conflicts and discuss what can be done to tackle the problem. My guests are Maria Ristimäki,
hi,
and Niklas Kaskela.
Hi.
Maria is project officer in CMI's Women in Peacemaking team and has recently focused on the conflict in the Lake Chad region in Western Africa. Niklas is CMI's fundraising manager, but also a climate change activist. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
So let's start with the big picture. I think we are all aware of the need to take urgent action against climate change and tackle these problems. But what's the big picture at the moment? How bad is the situation?
Well, I would say climate change is not something that is happening in the future. It's happening already now. In your intro, you mentioned that by the year 2050, some things might happen. But we're already seeing things happening quite rapidly. Just this week, there were temperatures over 50 degrees, daytime temperatures in northern India. Nighttime temperatures above 40 degrees, and one can ask: is that something? Are those temperatures suitable for humans? I would say most of us would not think so. So we're not talking about something that's going to happen in 10 or 15 years. It's actually we're experiencing it now. Global temperatures have risen from pre-industrial times already by 1 degree. And at current rate, the current rate of warming, we're increasing the global temperature by 0.2 degrees every decade. So at this rate, we'll go over the 1.5 degree so-called, well, not safe limit, but a limit that has been set by the world's governments in just a couple of decades, and 2 degrees soon after that. So I think the urgency is ever present. We basically just have a few years to reverse the current current warming, and we need urgent action. That's basically it. It's a question basically of the future of humankind. If we don't do anything, we might reach 3 to 4 degrees higher temperatures by the end of the century, and that might actually put at risk the entire human civilization.
Mm. That's a very scary vision. Maria, what's your take on this?
So I'm looking at this from the perspective of the connection between climate change and armed conflict. And as Niklas was saying, we can certainly already see the effects of climate change in societies. It's transforming the environment and societies where we live, and as such, of course, it also has an impact on the way conflict plays out. Now, there's no broad consensus on the exact workings of how climate change can influence the onset of armed conflict or how it plays out. But one, I think, interesting and important observation is that the countries that are currently experiencing the most severe effects of climate change, for example, in terms of extreme weather patterns, whether that's floods or droughts, are also countries that are very often susceptible to armed conflict or very fragile otherwise. So I think that is something that we have to appreciate. And climate change is often spoken about as an intensifier of conflicts and a factor that can kind of stoke the underlying tensions in a given society. So I think it's definitely something we have to appreciate as a major and an increasingly important factor in international peace and security.
Mm. You talked about the evidence between climate change and conflicts. There seems to be new evidence at the moment, sort of highlighting and strengthening this connection.
Yeah, there is. Just to get back on to Maria's point earlier, that these kind of countries that are most prone to climate change are also vulnerable to the risks from conflicts. I have a list here of the 10 most vulnerable countries to climate change. Number one is Somalia. Number two is Eritrea. Number three is Sudan. Number four is Burundi. Mm-hmm. So countries that we are well familiar with from international news and conflicts. We have Yemen on at number seven, Chad number eight. So definitely there is, I think climate change will increase the risk of conflict in these areas. Now there is a recent study that came out earlier this year, kind of confirming this causal link between climate change, migration, and conflicts. And this study looked at immigrants or refugees that came to Europe a few years ago during the so-called refugee crisis, and they were interviewed about which reasons they had for leaving their home countries. Mm. And then the scientists or the people conducting the study were able to kind of make a link that climate change was one of the root causes for them leaving their home country. So it led to drought, it led to people going into the cities, it led to overcrowding, it led to losses of livelihood and so forth. So then people were maybe forced to leave their homes. And I think this question of migration is certainly something that also links to conflicts, not just in the countries where people are leaving, but in the countries where they might end up. We have to remember that most refugees and asylum seekers are actually in the neighboring countries to the conflict, not coming to Europe or other developed countries. So there might be some regional tensions there when tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of people start moving around due to climate change in the upcoming years.
And not necessarily even refugees, but I believe the World Bank has estimated that internally displaced persons, people moving within a given country, number of those people can increase by 140 million at 2050 as a result of climate change. And this is one of the kind of more indirect effects that you can identify that climate change has on conflicts and the onset of armed conflict, the effect that it has on migration. And that can, of course, kind of stoke tensions in a given country between IDPs and the communities where they end up. However, I would really also emphasize the importance of just politics and governance and the way these things are mitigated. The fact that people move is not in and of itself necessarily a source of or a cause of conflict. Now, a more direct way, a more direct link between climate change and conflict is, I think, in terms of the impact that it has on weather patterns. And this makes societies that are dependent on especially rain-fed agriculture really vulnerable and has an impact, a negative impact on food security. And this kind of, the thinking goes that this competition over scarce resources is kind of a major cause of conflict. Again, I think we have to look at the bigger picture and appreciate some of the contextual differences. Scarce resources. I mean, resources are scarce in many places that don't experience conflict. So it's more complicated than that. But there's definitely some connections you can identify.
Mm. How does this show in your work? You've been focusing on the Lake Chad region. How do these problems show in your work?
The Lake Chad Basin is an often cited example when it comes to climate change and conflict. Now the area, it's a freshwater lake at the intersection of Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon and Chad in Western Central Africa. And it's a region that depends on the main kind of three main sources of livelihoods for the people of Lake Chad. It's farming, fishing and livestock farming. So all of those are very much dependent on weather and the kind of predictability of weather patterns and rainfalls and this has kind of changed in the past decades. It's become more unpredictable and it's put a lot of pressure and on societies that are already quite food insecure to begin with. And so I think the effect of climate change in the livelihoods of Lake Chad Basin is very visible. And given that the armed conflict there has now lasted for 10 years, the social fabric and trust between people has also been eroded. And that has been another major component of the economy and of society. Mm. And so the unpredictability of weather that now comes with climate change really adds to the stress that the society there is already under.
I think if I just add to that, we have to take into account that even small changes in temperature will increase these insecurities exponentially. So if we think of 1.5 degrees and the difference between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees, it doesn't sound that much to a, you know, half a degree. It doesn't sound like anything, but actually it can make a huge difference in terms of immigration. At 1.5 degrees, we're talking about tens of millions of people having to leave their homes due to climate related issues. Once we reach 2 degrees, we're talking about hundreds of millions. So there's a certain difference there. When it comes to water security, which you kind of referred to as well, that just a half of degree increase in temperature from 1.5 to 2 will double the amount of people living under so-called water stress, which means they don't have adequate amounts of water for their daily consumption. So I think each kind of even small increase in the temperature makes a huge difference, and this is something we need to consider when we mitigate climate change.
Mm. When we still talk about the situation in the Lake Chad Basin, what kind of efforts are there in place to tackle these problems?
There's a lot of adaptation, certainly, to be done when it comes to people's ability to cope with this increased predictability. However, one key aspect or very central aspect of the narrative of conflict in the Lake Chad Basin is the lake itself. And there's a very prominent narrative and belief that the lake is shrinking and that this has kind of contributed or caused the armed insurgency of jihadist group known as Boko Haram. Now, there's been recent studies even coming out this year that there's evidence actually to the contrary. The lake is being replenished and it's kind of increasing in terms of the amount of water in the lake. So I think there is certainly grounds to resist this kind of very simplifying narrative of a lake shrinks and therefore you have a jihadist insurgency. Now, the lake did shrink in the 1970s and 80s very visibly, and you even have these like satellite images that are very dramatic of is once very huge and massive oasis in the middle of what is almost desert, shrinking to a very small puddle even, and this drought during those decades actually contributed to migration to the cities. So people left the countryside, they were no longer able to make ends meet in the countryside and migrated to the cities in the region. Notably, The capital city of Borno State in northeast Nigeria, Maiduguri, received a lot of these incomers and transformed into this huge urban sprawl where inequalities were quite visible. Now, Boko Haram emerged in Maiduguri 10, 20 years later in one of the more marginalized neighborhoods of that city. Does this mean that the droughts caused the emergence of Boko Haram, what was first a preaching group and later on a violent jihadist group? I don't think so. I think we have to be quite cautious about drawing these very clear cause and effect or causal links between these really big phenomena. And there's certainly many more factors, particularly when it comes to justice, when it comes to inequalities, when it comes to ideas about politics and governance and etc. So it's a really complex set of factors that contributed to the way the conflict in the Lake Chad Basin started and the way it has played out. But there are also certain factors that you can see that are related to the environment and to climate change.
Mm. If we move to CMI's work, what can be done with CMI's help in the region?
I think actors like CMI can really play an important role. Really anyone who can facilitate people coming together and discussing issues of joint concern will have a very important role to play when we resolve, whether we resolve conflicts or whether we're talking about mitigating the effects of climate change. I think it comes down to governance. We have to govern better. We have to address inequalities. We have to address some of the tensions within societies to enable people to respond to the changes brought on by climate change and armed conflict. And in that process, trust building, facilitating dialogue can be very important, whether that's at the local level or between countries, as in the case of the Lake Chad Basin, that is now a conflict that's crossed borders. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Definitely.
So to put it in concrete terms, CMI has brought together people in different forums, for example?
In the Lake Chad Basin, CMI has supported the Lake Chad Basin Governors Forum, which was set up last year. And it brings together governors from the 9 most affected areas most affected by the Boko Haram insurgency to kind of discuss the shared challenge and find ways forward, especially when it pertains to some of the cross-border dimensions of the conflict. Now, I think those kinds of platforms, by creating channels of communication and creating trust between different decision makers, can really contribute to also the challenge of responding to and mitigating the effects of climate change. And I think that's a lens. Climate change is kind of a lens that we have to bring on board in our work, analytically and otherwise.
Mm-hmm. What about other regions? Do you have examples of CMI's work tackling some of the problems caused by climate change?
Well, I think we're present in many of the regions where climate change is already a significant factor. If you look at North Africa, Libya, look at Yemen, also in Asia. So I think it's something that plays a role in all of our projects or programs, basically. And I think when you think about the role of what CMI can do is we're not a climate organization, right? We're not an actor in that sense in the climate movement, or our role is not to mitigate climate change. But what we can do is help these societies adapt to changing conditions. And here I reference to what Maria just said, is that building institutions that people can trust in is crucial. Building dialogue between different groups is crucial. Climate conditions are going to change. That's going to cross problems. But we need to have the tools, and the people on the ground there in these areas need to have the tools to be able to kind of adapt to the changing conditions. And I think in general, when we talk about climate efforts, we talk about mitigation a lot. And that's also where most of the financial flows go. If you think about us in the so-called global north supporting countries in the global south in terms of climate change, most of the flows, financial flows, go to mitigation efforts and not that much to adaptation. And as I already told you earlier, that we're already experiencing climate change, so we need to urgently focus also on adaptation and helping these societies adapt. And that's also a climate justice thing. They're countries that are the least responsible for the problem, but they're bearing the worst consequences. So I think it's also our duty. Countries like Finland, who have the possibility to assist these countries, to do our fair share.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Maria?
No, I can only agree with what Niklas is saying. I think sub-Saharan Africa counts for about 5%, if not less, of the global carbon emissions. And yeah, you can see the effects that climate change is having there. And there's definitely a moral kind of dimension to this issue in terms of justice. Justice in terms of global north and global south, if you want to use those terms, but also intergenerational justice. And I think young people, the role of young people in the world, if you speak globally, is one of marginalization, quite many ways, economic and political and otherwise, and you can also see it in the as a dynamic in many of the conflicts where we work. But it's also an issue that's very relevant to climate change. I mean, young people are the real stakeholders here, and those who have very little in terms of political power to make the decisions that have to be made will be the people who are going to be here when the effects of climate change intensify. So, yeah, I think there's definitely many dimensions to this issue.
Yeah. I just happened to, just a sort of fact that gives you a perspective, I happened to look yesterday at the per capita emissions or carbon footprint of a Congolese person. Mm. It's about 1% of a Finn's per capita climate or carbon footprint. So the entire population of the DRC, which is about 80 million, I think, at the moment, produces less emissions than 5 million Finns. So you can this also gives us some perspective of kind of where the problem lies and where it has to be solved.
So climate change, it's sort of just another dimension to CMI's work. I mean, it comes at the top of what we're doing already, whether it's sort of building solid state institution or doing some other kind of conflict prevention work. Would you agree with this?
Yeah, I think our role is definitely in the kind of scene of adaptation and helping societies adapt, but also in building trust in institutions, not only national institutions, but also multinational and the kind of whole international system.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, we're seeing a kind of breakdown of this system due to some maybe superpowers that are against it. I think like international cooperation is basically our only chance of tackling climate change. So maybe we can play a role there as well. And I don't know, I think in international climate negotiations are a tough place as well. And maybe sometime in the future we can also lend a hand there too. We are experienced in bringing different kind of conflict parties together, and the top level climate negotiations, one could argue that there's a conflict going on there. Perhaps that needs solving as well.
Mm.
I would second that and add that it's not only cooperation on the international level, but all levels. And at best, I think you can see climate change as an opportunity to bring people together in very divided societies. It can be a theme that might be less politicized. It might be less personal or less to do with the dynamics in a given society. I mean, it's a global phenomenon, and it has real effects on people's lives. So it can be a way to bring people together across very, very deep divisions in a given society. And I think there's definitely more room to do more of that work and to do to kind of see this preventative, almost like conflict prevention work, also in terms of adaptation to climate change or the effects of climate change. And yeah, there's a way to also to find something positive or to find an opportunity in this challenge that we're facing.
Mm. So the effects of climate change can also build bridges between people, so to speak.
Yes, and they can also, I mean, the interest, the mutual interest of managing resources and adapting to the effects of climate change can be a way to bring people together.
Mm. So just to sum up a little bit, is this a phenomenon that we take seriously enough? I mean, there's a lot of talk of maybe other sides of climate change, but not so much about the links between climate change and conflicts. Is this a phenomenon that we take seriously enough?
Well, I think the kind of there hasn't been so much bulletproof evidence of climate change and the links between climate change and conflicts. We're just recently seeing academic studies that you know build on this link.
Mm-hmm.
And even there, climate change is one of the causes for the conflict, but you need to combine, you know, weak institutions,
mm-hmm.
overpopulation. There are other factors that come into play as well. So I think we need maybe more robust evidence as well in this sense before we can, you know, take it more seriously, if I get back to your question. But definitely, I mean, climate change is something, it's an existential, basically, threat to humanity. So no sector or no, you know, area life can exclude it. So definitely also the sector and where CMI works needs to focus on it even more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree. There's no broad consensus on the exact links between climate change and conflict, but given the magnitude of changes that are already happening and that are coming. Depending slightly on whether we mitigate warming or global warming or not, I think it's pretty evident that this is something that has to be incorporated not only into the work of people resolving conflicts, but everyone's work, and it has implications on every part of society. And it's just a matter of finding those links and seeing how we can, through our work, whatever it is that we're doing, also help societies mitigate and adapt to climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also as an organization, CMI has a certain responsibility. And I'm really happy that recently we have made some decisions within CMI to cut our own emissions, actually, as well. Obviously, we travel a lot, and it's part of our work. So we've made some ambitious plans to cut our emissions from traveling or flying by 20% in the upcoming, before 2021, and that we're also going to offset emissions from our travel. So it's a small, I wouldn't call it a gesture, but I think that's sort of, we all have to take responsibility for climate change. No one else is going to solve it for us, you know? If someone's going to solve it, it's going to be us. And just mm-hmm. like our founder and former chairman of the board, President Ahtisaari, mm-hmm. has said, if people have started something, they can end it. And he referred to conflicts and wars, right? But I think the same applies to climate change. Something that people have started, we can also put a stop to it.
That's a very important way to finish this. Thank you, Maria and Niklas.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to CMI's Peace Talks with Antti Ämmälä. If you like our show, please subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your friends. You can also send us feedback and propose topics to discuss via social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or by sending email to comms@cmi.fi.